Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Homelessness in Mecklenburg County was at its highest point this year, greater than at any time since 2010. The point in time count revealed a homeless population of 444. That's 60 more people than last year. And this is coming at a time of diminishing resources. The reasons for homelessness are as many as there are ideas for solutions. Right now, Donald Trump's solution for Washington, D.C., is to promise to remove homeless encampments from parks and public spaces. He has declared the, quote, homeless have to move out immediately, all caps. But where are they supposed to go? His administration has also cut funding for nonprofit organizations nationwide, which have worked to help homeless people by providing for both their immediate needs and helping them in finding more permanent housing. The cuts are disrupting decades-old partnerships. To be honest, this is a problem that many have been working on for a very long time, but it's one that seems only to be growing. So what might work? What strategies have worked? And can any strategies work in an environment where monetary support has been cut and in which philanthropy is on the decline? We look into that this hour with the help of Liz Clayson Kelly. She's the CEO of Roof Above, which has been working on solutions here in our own backyard for quite a while. Karen Pelletier is Mecklenburg County's Director of Housing Innovation and Stabilization Services. And Marcy Thompson is Vice President of Policy and Programs at the National Alliance to End Homelessness. Thank you all for being here. Good morning. Welcome. Good morning. I want to begin with you, Karen. The 444 number that I mentioned just a moment ago is a little misleading. That is the number, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, that is the number of people who were sheltered or unsheltered, or both, on a single night in 2025, and it was higher than the year before. But the county's State of Housing Instability and Homelessness report from 2024 shows a much higher number of homeless individuals, 2,784, and it too was up from the year before by 33%. Explain the difference in those numbers, Karen.
Sure. And so for a little bit of context, the 444 individuals that were identified on a point in time count, those were individuals that are living unsheltered somewhere in Mecklenburg County, which is an increase from this time, the last point in time count. But overall, our point in time count number was up to just over 2,100 individuals. And that is that truly that snapshot of how many people are experiencing homelessness on this specific night, whether you're living in shelters, transitional housing, unsheltered. So that is what HUD uses as a guise, and every community does a point in time count. What Mecklenburg County also does is we have a one number that we also use to kind of guide what the level of need is. And that's on any given time, on any given day, not just that night in January, but how many people today can we say are experiencing homelessness? And that number is up, that we're up over now as of today, over 2,400 people that we have somewhere in our community, mostly in shelter or unsheltered, and other places that may be hidden, basically, from the general public.
So, Marcy, you deal with this on a national level. You see this in lots of different cities. Put that number, whether it's 2,784 or the number that she just referenced, 2,400 people, put that into some sort of context for a city the size of Charlotte. How do we compare to other similarly sized cities? Do you know?
I don't know off the top of my head, but I would say that that is probably pretty average at this point. I think we're seeing increases in communities. We're seeing homelessness go up in lots of different communities, including communities that in the past maybe had more steady numbers, especially as the affordable housing crisis continues to persist.
Liz, you've been working on this right here on the ground level for many years, and Charlotte voters have approved hundreds of millions of dollars to help shore up the stock of affordable housing over the last several years. We do have our share of shelters and organizations who run shelters and provide services, including yours, A Roof Above. But the number of homeless people continues to grow. Are we making any headway, or is this like playing whack-a-mole?
Well, I think it's always important to recognize the connections between our prosperity and the realities of homelessness. So Charlotte is prospering, it's growing, people are moving here. We are not building housing at the same rate that people are moving here. So our housing system is stressed. And what we see is rising rents. And what data, when you look at cities, there's actually this fascinating relationship. Actually, the higher poverty is in a community, we see this corresponding lower homelessness, because when there's higher poverty, there tends to be lower rents. So what we really see is this connection: as our rents increase, we see homelessness increase. So you won't hear me say we aren't making progress, because as you mentioned, I'm on the ground level and I see every single day we move people from homelessness to housing. But if you span back, you see that all the millions we're spending to create more housing, it's not keeping up with the ways we're losing housing, really with investors coming in, buying housing stock, increasing rents, because we're a prospering and growing community.
So you're saying that prosperity in the general population is creating a worse situation for those who are not benefiting from that prosperity. Marcy, I know you want to get in on this.
Yeah, I mean, I think the gap is getting bigger. In terms of where are the folks that are experiencing prosperity versus those that are in poverty, I would challenge us to maybe like not just look at the number of people who are experiencing homelessness at any point in time, but how many people are falling into homelessness at any point in time, and how many people is the community actually able to serve year over year over year. I would venture to guess, without putting my colleagues here on the spot, that they're serving more folks each year than they did the year prior. And so I think that there's this sometimes false sense that that number is static, that this is the same, you know, 2,400 people includes the 2,100 that were homeless last year, when in reality, most of the folks that were homeless last year probably have been housed. And these are new folks coming into the system because the rents are so high that more people are becoming homeless for the first time.
So we're not building enough homes or apartments to deal with the incoming population, Karen. Gentrification is occurring. Investors are coming in and buying what have previously been lower income housing and turning it into something a little more expensive than that. Inflation is high and it continues to rise, and resources are diminishing from various different areas, including the federal level. And because people in their ordinary daily lives are finding themselves strapped for cash, they're not giving donations in the rate that perhaps they could have done so in the past. As you witness all this and the rising numbers of homeless people in Charlotte, what's your biggest fear, Karen?
I think there's many fears tied for first place, to be honest with you. And I think it's really about the core of it is about the misinformation of it. That people are afraid that if they're either contributing their tax dollars to solve for solutions or through philanthropy with donations, that they think, oh, well, it's not going to, you know, it's not doing any good. There's not any, you know, I still see people living on the streets as I'm coming into Uptown Charlotte. And so that to me is the biggest fear, that these narratives that are being shared at the national level, people are going to really start believing, when we know that Housing First works, we know that we're getting a return on our investment, and that we have been able to be innovative in some of our solutions. So that's what I would really talk about. And I think that's why I appreciate opportunities to talk about this is what's working. This is what we know we need to invest in to preserve naturally occurring affordable housing, creating more housing for individuals that may never be able to make market rate housing. And so those are the things that we really are trying to manage.
There is this impression, you are correct, that this is a never-ending problem, a constant churn of individuals in and out of the situation of homelessness that they find themselves in, perhaps temporarily, but it's a constant churn. And no matter how many resources we put toward it, it seems to never go away. And Marcy, you look at this on the national level, and I was thinking about this yesterday because of this program, just curious as to when all this began, because when I was a child or a young teenager, I don't recall seeing homeless people on the streets ever. Yeah. And I grew up in the Washington area. And the first time I saw a homeless person on the street, it was shocking. They were sleeping on a grate in the middle of the day during the Reagan administration. That's when I saw it. So yeah. When did this begin?
You just named it. I think in the 80s is when we certainly saw what we consider modern day homelessness. Certainly there were people that were unhoused before that, but kind of the what we see now.
So why?
Then,
what happened?
So, a lot has happened over the years. I think there was a huge disinvestment in HUD resources during that time. HUD's budget had been slashed. So I think that was certainly a huge piece of it. The gap between the wealthy and the poor continued to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And so the ability to kind of get yourself out of certain circumstances, I think, just changed over time. But I think it's important to look at the 2010s, because we did see a strong period of national decreases across the country in every population. We saw the biggest decreases in veteran homelessness, but we saw decreases in family homelessness and chronic homelessness across the board. We had bipartisan support. I've done this work for over 20 years, most of it in the federal space. There was bipartisan support. There were different opinions about maybe the solutions, but we didn't have to fight for people to see homeless folks as human beings. We never had to fight those narratives. That, I think, has been more, to Karen's point, has been more pervasive over the last 8 years and has made everything more challenging and difficult.
Liz, as Marcy was talking, both you and Karen were nodding vigorously in agreement with the progression of events. You want to give your slant on this as well?
The only event I would add, because I think it really relates to the narratives today, is deinstitutionalization. So there was a time when people struggled with severe and persistent mental illness. They would be sent away to institutions for life. And in the mid to late 70s, we saw a move away from that policy, but we did not fund alternatives. And I think this is important as we talk about approaches like Housing First, because really in many ways, I feel like we're trying to go back and create those alternatives for folks with significant disabling conditions. How do you create the environments where they can have a level of independence, a quality of life, but also have the supports they need to maintain stability? So I think that's an important part of the story as well.
Liz Clayson Kelly is the CEO of Roof Above, an organization that desperately tries to find solutions for the homeless. Karen Pelletier is Mecklenburg County's Director for Housing Innovation and Stabilization Services, and Marcy Thompson is VP for Policy and Programs at the National Alliance to End Homelessness. We have a lot to cover, a lot of ground to cover, and we will do that when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the problem of homelessness, the challenge, and possible solutions in the face of declining funding from various sources. Liz Clayson-Kelly is with us from Roof Above, Karen Pelletier from Mecklenburg County, and Marcy Thompson from the National Alliance to End Homelessness. Marcy, in April, the Trump administration, through DOGE, effectively shut down the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. It's a tiny agency that coordinated homelessness policy across the federal government, as well as coordinating with state and local governments around the country. What has been the impact of that?
As a former USICH employee, I can actually, both a former employee as well as a former HUD employee who worked very closely with a past iteration of the agency. I think that the immediate impact has maybe not been felt. I think the real impact is what it could be. USICH as an organization, when it has been the most effective, has been when it has been able to really bring together the federal agencies for a coordinated response, be able to promote evidence-based practices. I think certainly in this administration, the ability for that team potentially to be able to promote those sorts of practices may have been more limited. I think it's more of a loss of what we could have and what they could mean for the work.
Well, evidently, some of the impact of the closure of that agency has filtered down, at least in North Carolina, Karen, that the state's 12 continuum of care programs, which work to prevent and end homelessness by providing a range of housing and other services, are now operating with reduced federal guidance and reduced supportive services and technical support. Charlotte-Mecklenburg's continuum of care was facing the potential of new compliance burdens coupled with reduced federal compensation, according to resources that I read about the closure of this agency. Has that come to pass, or is that lurking in your near future?
I would say it is definitely lurking. Mecklenburg County staff are actually as the collaborative applicant, we have Mecklenburg County staff that oversee these functions right now. That we are continuing to operate as business as usual because we have over 500 people that are in these housing programs that are funded through HUD. So we are trying to stay steady in making sure that people remain in housing, that people stay connected to services, and continue to just operate with hope that the funding will continue because it's working. And cutting funding doesn't mean that there isn't the need. The need will only increase, and our streets will be full of more people in really dire situations.
And Liz, Roof Above has its own continuum of care program, which provides housing subsidies to young adults who would otherwise be experiencing homelessness. DOGE took a bull in a china shop approach to cuts across the government that would have been better served with a scalpel and some detailed analysis before those cuts occurred. Has there been any pressure for them to rethink the cuts that are now affecting you and others who are providing services? Any pressure at all?
That particular program was caught up, if you remember that day when it was announced that all federal funding would be paused. We wouldn't be paid on contracts for a period of time. It was a very active 48 hours. And so that contract has been reinstated. We continue to house young adults coming out of homelessness and I believe do so effectively. And so that was more a pause of when payment occurred and pause of contracts. We do anticipate with the recent executive order, it's a little unclear what it will mean, but certainly the executive order has language which indicates their likely will not be funding for Housing First programs. And Roof Above gets about $850,000 from this grant for multiple programs that operate using a Housing First philosophy.
Marcy, all the things that we've talked about that are headwinds that people working with the homeless and trying to fix that problem face are also being exacerbated by other things that the government has done, the administration has done in the last 8 months. When you consider what that is, including the elimination of a great swath of the federal workforce, which doesn't just work in Washington, they work across the country. And in the national parks, et cetera, when you eliminate all those people, and when you have things becoming more expensive, and you eliminate funding for federal programs, including social programs, do you anticipate the homeless problem becoming more difficult, more noticeable, more problematic in the near future?
I see homelessness continuing to increase for sure. I you know, people experiencing homelessness are many other things beyond just, you know, homeless folks, and they're going to be falling through the cracks. People are going to fall through the cracks more and more. These actions certainly aren't making anything more efficient. I think that is definitely clear. I think a big concern, particularly coming off of the recent activity in Washington, D.C. in the executive order, is that there is going to be more of an effort by the administration to disappear people, you know, that placing folks in institutions or placing folks in jail will give a false sense of that something is working because it becomes less visible, and that just isn't the reality.
I want to follow up on that executive order that you're talking about. I'm not sure that people are aware of what just happened in the last week or so, but before we get to that, Karen, the same question. I mean, given the fact that you have all these federal workers being displaced, that we do have instances of rising employment challenges, rising costs for everything, a slow housing market that makes it more difficult for people on the low end of the economic scale to find a place to live. What, if anything, and the fact that the government is shifting a lot of the responsibility of this away from the federal government toward local and state governments, what is the county doing to get ready for all of this?
So one of the things that we're really starting to look at is our data a little differently. In November, we started collecting zip code data from people that are calling our coordinated entry system, which is our portal to our homeless response system. And we are able to better understand that we are seeing people moving to Charlotte who came here for a job or a relationship or whatever reason, and things didn't work out. And now here they are in Mecklenburg. And out of people that are moving here, we are seeing more people from other places in North Carolina coming here. And it's folks that may not have a depth of resource available, but here they are, and now they need help. And so it's helping us better understand and how we think about homelessness as a region, and not just the bubble of Mecklenburg, but how are we working to help support in this area. But we can't do it alone, though, that we can't continue to bear the cost of all the things that historically have come from the federal government or have come from the state, and now local governments are being forced to make really difficult decisions.
And if it were just that, that would be one thing, but it's not that alone. There are a lot of things that are being shifted to the states and to the local governments that there's simply not enough money to go around to fund those things. Liz, in March, you said that the Trump administration suggested government cuts combined with a decline in donations to your organization could cause Roof Above to lose 23% of its funding. That's $400,000 a month. Did that happen? Have changes brought by the Trump administration come home to roost yet, or are you merely bracing for those changes?
Yeah, so that's the number that was our federal dollar number. So Roof Above is now on 9 campuses. We serve more than 1,400 people a day, and we do that through public-private partnerships. Part of that public, which is why Karen Pelletier and I talk so much, is significant local funding from the county. but 23% of our overall budget last year came from federal dollars. So when that pause came on federal payments, that is what was at risk for Roof Above. So to date, we've not seen those significant cuts. We've had one funding source, about $100,000 that we anticipate will not return. With the recent executive order, I know we'll talk about that in a minute, we think that's about $850,000 at risk. Now, there have been different versions. There's been the presidential suggested budget summary. There was the House budget for HUD, the Senate budget for HUD. So we are loving the word scenario planning these days. So we have the board working hard, our executive team working hard, asking what if. I do want to take a moment just to say thank you to this community, because we, Roof Above, can't do what it does without philanthropy. And this community stepped up over the last months to help us continue out our fiscal year at the first half of this year. So there is much unknown for us, but to date, we have not seen massive cuts, but we are bracing what's up ahead.
But last month in July, you announced that you would end your SABR program after August because of funding challenges. SABR is a 19-year-old substance abuse treatment program for men, which, according to your statistics, has been very successful. What will the end of this mean?
Yeah, the SABR program was a really special and effective treatment program. While we are ending the program in its place, we are turning that campus into supportive, substance-free, affordable housing. So it will be for men in recovery who are in need of affordable housing. So I think of it, well, yes, it is a program ending. And yes, what's in its place will generate revenue for us because people will be paying 30% of their income on rent. And so that is helpful to us. But it also stays within our skill set. It was our only treatment program that we operated. And really, our best skill sets are in providing housing and in providing emergency shelter and kind of homeless services. And so it was as much. Our board has encouraged us in these complicated times to say, how can we simplify what we do, focus on where our strongest gifts are, and then how do we scale that? Because the reality is the community needs us now more than ever. And so we have to figure out how to keep showing up. You know, Marcy talked about seeing increases. We had a 24% increase in the number of people served last year than the year before with constrained resources. And so we know the need is there. We know this community recognizes that and supports that. So we've got to navigate a future course. There's just a lot of unknowns and what that future course will be.
Marcy, as Liz will tell you, we have talked about this problem many times on this program. And we've talked with local people who have been working diligently to make a dent in this problem locally. But let me ask you a question that I've asked in the past, because I think it bears repeating for new listeners who may not be as familiar with this problem as you folks are. Who are the homeless? Why do they find themselves in this situation?
I mean, they're us. They're everybody. I mean, I think that there's this othering that happens sometimes where we talk about people experiencing homelessness as if that is their entire identity. But it's families with children. It's individuals. It's folks who maybe made a mistake 20 years ago, and that continues to follow them and be a barrier to employment and housing. It's a, unlike the narrative, it's some folks that have mental illness or substance use disorder. But it really is anybody can fall into homelessness. And certain folks, certain groups certainly have the things stacked against them that might make them more likely to fall into homelessness.
Karen, what I'm hearing Marcy say is that unless you were born with a silver spoon in your mouth, that all of us there, but by, for the grace of God go I, are in that precarious situation that something could happen. But it's not really all of us. It's people who are, who don't have a leg up, people who are one paycheck away from disaster. Is it middle class people? Is it upper middle class people too?
So I think when we talk in broad strokes that yes, it is, it literally can be anybody, any of us. But to Marcy's point, that there are people that are overrepresented in our homeless system, because homelessness truly is a result of all the other failures of systems, of our criminal justice system, our education system, our mental health system, healthcare, like all the things, it's a perfect storm. So if you are already a person in a population that is already not being able to advance because of all these other failures, yes, you are more likely to end up experiencing homelessness. And we know we had a prevention project last year that Community Solutions, our partner, helped us sponsor. And we were able to truly find that the people that were calling for help were people who were experiencing poverty and happened to get sick and missed a few days of work. And then their car broke down. And then they had a loved one die and had to pay for funerals. Like, this is what our data showed, is who is calling our system desperate for help. And we know that once you have an eviction on your record, you're not getting back into housing in Mecklenburg County, because that's just not, the landlords can pick and choose who they, who they're able to help and sign leases with. And so, I think that this is where we have to really think about what are we doing with prevention, because any of us could end up in the system. And sometimes, and it is that some people are more likely to end up in our system.
Liz.
If I could throw in a data point, because this is one of those data points that keeps me up at night. If we look at households earning between $50,000 and $75,000, right? So I remember when I made it to that point, I felt like I am stable. This is solid. 61% of households earning that who are renting are paying more than 30% of their income on rent. So they cannot afford their rent, which means when those things that Karen mentioned, the car breaks down, you get sick, you go through a divorce, you are very vulnerable because you are paying more than 30% of your income on rent. And that's 61% of people $50,000 to $75,000. That is a huge increase in the last 10 years. That's what's changing in our context. So we see more and more households, even modest income households, who are vulnerable to one crisis pushing them into a housing crisis.
Marcy, I have about 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Just to make the point that people's circumstances change. So even the person that was born with the silver spoon, that doesn't mean that that's going to be their circumstance forever. And so, you know, just remembering that point, that even if you're okay right now, doesn't mean you're going to be okay forever. And we see that in particular with the number of older adults who are falling into homelessness.
When we come back, I want to explore just a little bit more about who these people are and how they find themselves in these circumstances. But then I want to talk about this new executive order that has been alluded to, and it immediately pertains to people in Washington, D.C., but it has consequences or implications for the rest of the country. We'll do that when we come back.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte, aiming to inspire high school students through an international curriculum and IB diploma program, preparing them for college, careers, and a global community. More at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the challenges surrounding homelessness with Liz Clayson-Kelly, CEO of Roof Above. Marcy Thompson is Vice President of Policy and Programs at the National Alliance to End Homelessness. And Karen Pelletier is Mecklenburg County Director for Housing Innovation and Stabilization Services. I think it was Marcy, Liz, who mentioned that some people have substance abuse problems. Some of the homeless have substance abuse problems, and that is a disease. It may have started out as a choice, but it becomes a disease. They also maybe have mental health issues. Of the people that you work with and that you are aware of who find themselves in this situation, what's the percentage of people who are homeless because of financial struggles that they've just had to cope with suddenly that they didn't see coming, versus people who are dealing with these other problems like mental health issues and substance abuse issues?
Well, I always think the cause of homelessness is this disconnect between the cost of housing and what your income is, right? So I think for all people, they share that in common. The question would be, why is your income what it is? So we've seen an increasing number of people we serve who are on fixed income, either because they're seniors or because folks are disabled. So that, you know, I've done this work for a lot of years and that disability check has not increased much in my 20 years on the ground level. And when, you know, if your check was $800, you could maybe in the past find an apartment for $500 and wasn't a great quality of life, but you could make it work. Now people's checks might be, you know, $900 and you can't find any place that rents above $1,000. So we see an increasing number of people, more than half of the folks we serve have a disabling condition of some kind and have a lot of vulnerability. Likewise, we see people, and Mike, I know you're big on, are we paying people enough for the jobs? Because if we paid people more, they could maybe afford the apartments in this community. So we have seen an increase in wages post-COVID, but it has not been as large as the increase in the corresponding increase in rents. And so the most recent, what's called the housing wage, like if you were working full-time, what you would need to make an hour, if you were working 40 hours a week to like a modest two bedroom apartment. And in Charlotte, Mecklenburg now that is $35. And like, we are not, they're not frontline jobs paying $35 an hour. So we're doing more work around connecting to careers. But for our seniors and folks who are disabled, that's not the path forward.
And Karen, to be clear, some people who are homeless have jobs that they go to every single day. Recently, airport workers asked for changes because some of them, they say, are sleeping in their cars. They're going to work every morning, cleaning airplanes, restocking supplies in airplanes, and yet they're sleeping in their cars. That means they are the working homeless or the homeless working, whichever way you want to put it. I don't know if they were included in the point in time count. Were they? And if not, does that mean that we actually have more homeless people than we know about?
So, yeah, so we do know that we have individuals that that are working, that have earned income, that just can't afford to live anywhere, or they have an eviction on their record, or they have no credit, which can be just as bad for some landlords. So but to your question, we know, like in our point in time count data, that we work to capture as many people as possible. We know in our point in time count data, people were earning income and disclosed that they had income. But that's why we also mark our one number too, that really helps to give us that more robust data to really better understand who is in our system. So we know the point in time count is an underreport. We know the one number may get us a little bit closer, but on any given day, we know people's housing situation fluctuates.
Marcy, prior to the start of the Trump administration, your organization, the National Alliance to End Homelessness, published this statement, quote, "Local governments face major limitations to addressing homelessness that federal and state governments do not due to budget or administration capacity constraints. There are certain problems that are simply outside of a local government's capacity to solve alone, given the scale of the problem." Well, now that the federal government is slashing that funding, can local governments logistically, realistically pick up the slack?
I mean, I think that the props, I think Liz, you might have, Liz or Karen said something about the other systems failing. And I think that is honestly what we keep seeing, is that these local homelessness response systems are scrappy and capable, and they're going to figure out how to do the work at the expense of all of these other systems just not doing what they're supposed to be doing. So I think that it is, it's a hard question to answer, because should the homelessness response system have to solve for all of these other things, or should we be putting that burden of responsibility back on local, state, and federal systems to do a better job to keep people stable?
So whether or not a person is homeless depends on lots of different things. It also depends on social programs. And this big, beautiful bill that recently passed in Washington does many things, allegedly with an eye to cutting wasteful spending and making a dent in our deficit. In many cases, though, it puts the burden for funding things that have been the responsibility of the federal government, or at least a joint effort between federal and state and local governments, squarely on those state and local governments. Estimates are this bill will cost Mecklenburg County $53 million to fill the gaps caused by changes to the Medicaid and SNAP programs. This county has 400,000 people on Medicaid, some of whom are homeless, some of whom are not, and 137,000 on SNAP, same thing. That's the largest number of any county in the state. And that has County Commissioner Lee Altman a little more than concerned.
I have a feeling of vertigo, like I'm standing on a cliff that I'm about to fall off of. And I respect the manager's statement that we don't want to alarm or scare anybody, but I have to say I'm both alarmed and scared. Sure.
So, Karen, although it isn't just the homeless who are going to be impacted by these changes, they are a subset. How is this likely to impact those people and the food banks and other entities that serve their needs?
Well, we are already getting word from our food banks and those other support safety net programs that are also desperate to keep food on the shelves for people as they fall in. And we think about like homelessness, it happens, it's slow and steady, and then all at once. And so people, it starts with people not having enough money for food, and then they don't have enough money for electricity. And then they don't have, and then it's this gradual. So when we talk about making these drastic cuts in two primary things of food and healthcare, because we're not like, because Medicaid is also on the table. When we take away those safety nets, there's nowhere else for people to fall but into homelessness.
Liz, these cuts nationwide coincide with something we've also alluded to, inflation. It's put the pinch on lots of people, even people with money who go to the grocery store now, and where they used to spend $30, they're spending $90 for two bags of groceries. Nobody can afford that ultimately, and that puts a dent in what they can afford to give to the community through their philanthropic practices. Even if philanthropy wasn't diminishing, could it fill the gap created by what's going on around you?
You know, well, my master's in public policy, and I just have a deep belief in the public good. And so when I think about how this country has responded and with some major public policies through the years, really does call forth what's best in us. And to say, when we all do a little bit, we can improve the quality of life for our whole community. And I think, I mean, what I see, and from my vantage point, because I spend a lot of time with folks who spend time uptown and have grave concerns with the impacts of unsheltered homelessness on our business community, on tourism, right? So when we don't take care of vulnerable people, there are costs that go to others of us as well. So in short, could philanthropy potentially cover it? That would be a real stretch. I never want to say, you know, it's completely impossible, because I trust that this community will figure out how to care for its neighbors. But I think it's best held in a public-private partnership. And I think the federal, state, and local community all have a role, as well as philanthropy, to play.
And voters in Mecklenburg County, Karen, as I've said many times, have voted in resources to try to increase or stabilize the amount of homeless amount of housing available through these bonds that we passed to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. Mecklenburg County has allocated close to $150 million toward addressing homelessness and providing affordable housing. But you say that you have heard people say that we are spending too much. I'm sure that you disagree. So I'd like you to explain why we are not spending too much.
So it would be difficult to make an argument that we're spending too much when you can look around our community and still see the dire needs of people. And it cannot be the role of local government to solve for all of this alone, whether that's whether it's through city funding or whether it's through the housing trust fund with the city, or with local county dollars, that it is going to take people donating. It is going to take our business community. It is going to take all of this. And so, but to the earlier point of, if we are only solving for homelessness and we're only funding homelessness, that's the only thing we're solving for, because we also need to take a look at how are we funding our mental health system? How are we funding our school system? How are we funding healthcare for people, because those are the driving forces on this. So we are a gritty bunch of folks trying to do really good, difficult work. And also many of the people that even work in this space may also be eligible for some of the services.
Nationally, Marcy, because this is a problem nationally, but we underfund education, at least according to the courts, in North Carolina. We probably underfund many other services that Karen just spoke about as well. What's the question here? Are we saving more money than it's costing us to not spend that money?
No. I think a lot of the approaches that we see at the local, state, and federal level are investing in the wrong things and are cutting in places thinking that this is going to be a cost savings, but the repercussions are going to be far more expensive down the road. So, I think that whether it's education, foster care, certainly with the jail system and the criminal justice system, we see how all of that plays out.
I want to talk about this recent executive order that we've been alluding to throughout this program. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump's recent executive actions and public statements have advocated for involuntary commitment or jail for the homeless in Washington, D.C. According to the White House, homeless individuals in D.C. are being given a choice: enter a shelter or treatment program, or face jail time or fines. And a lot of people fear that this would not only violate civil rights, but shift homeless individuals into long-term institutional settings, many of them run by private companies that would be reimbursed by the government, which may be part of the plan. If this takes hold in D.C., do you worry, Karen, that the next logical step would be to move this to the states, especially red states like North Carolina?
We actually, and I think Liz can speak to this too, have done a tremendous, because I believe our General Assembly tried to enact something very similar, that we were able to, through advocacy and people really understanding what does that mean when we're making poverty and homelessness illegal, and what that does from a human element, as well as that it that would be very expensive. So why not fund what we know is working and continue to add there versus criminalizing people who then will never have an option to live in community.
And we seem to be canceling certain things that we know are working. The New York Times reports this morning that midway through Trump's first administration, his top Veterans Affairs officials hailed as an extraordinary achievement a government housing program that had reduced homelessness among veterans by nearly one half since 2010. Well, that program has now been swept aside, or is being swept aside, by the current Trump administration in an executive order that he issued last month. He instructed government agencies to stop funding Housing First programs, which the order said, quote, deprioritize accountability and failed to promote treatment, recovery, and self-sufficiency. These are our veterans, not just ordinary homeless people. These are people who have served the country. What's your reaction to all of this? I don't care who answers that question. Go ahead, Marcy.
I can start. I think two things. First, I think, Housing First is an approach that has been used for over a decade at this point. And if you look at HUD programs and you look at the VA is a healthcare system. Housing First has been massively successful in the VA programs because they have the resources to pair the housing voucher that's provided by HUD and the services and case management at the levels that are needed through the VA. On the HUD side, we don't see that sort of investment. And so there's this false correlation between the rise in homelessness and the failure of the approaches, but you can't actually blame a resource that doesn't exist for not being able to work.
And this New York Times report says that though veterans are not mentioned explicitly in this executive order, correct, they are at the heart of the nation's homelessness crisis. Roughly one in every 11 homeless person is a veteran. And they fear that if this order is strictly applied, some veterans will lose their housing and others will decide not to seek treatment at all. And we'll leave it at that because we are out of time. The problem will continue. And it's one of my questions that I didn't get to ask was, after all these years of dealing this with this, why don't we have a universal problem that seems to work? But that's a show for another day. Liz Clayson Kelly, CEO of Roof Above, Karen Pelletier, Mecklenburg County Director of Housing Innovation and Stabilization Services, and Marcy Thompson with the National Alliance to End Homelessness.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.